This podcast is not meant to be professional advice of any kind. It is meant to be informative and entertaining. If you make any changes to your life, see the appropriate professional before you do so. What kind of super ager are you? Go to ageist.com/quiz, take the super ager quiz, and we'll send you directed, personalized information to help you super age the best that you can. Welcome to Super Age. My name's David Stewart. I am the founder of Ageist and your host on the Super Age show. We talk about how to live healthier, how to live longer, and how to be happier. And who doesn't want that? Today's show is brought to you by Inside Tracker, the dashboard to your inner health. Go to insidetracker.com/ageist, save 20% on all their products. Today's show is also brought to you by Element, L-M-N-T. My favorite electrolyte mix. It's what I put in my water in the morning, and it's what I put in my water at the gym. Go to drinkelement.com/ageist and receive a free 8-serving sample pack with any purchase. Today's show is also brought to you by Timeline Nutrition with their breakthrough product, MitoPure, the first clinically tested urolithin A supplement, which is showing tremendous results for mitochondrial health. Go to timelinenutrition.com/ageist, use the code ageist at checkout, and save 10% off your first order of MitoPure. Welcome to episode 174 of the Super Age Podcast. This will be dropping on March 6, 2024. This week on the show, we have a scientist from Denmark, Sunye Lehmann. I hope I pronounced that right, Sunye. Apologies if I didn't. Who's going to be talking to us about using AI, large language models, and big data to possibly predict lifespan outcomes, you know, to predict when you're going to die. So I read a paper that he put out a few months ago, and we've been waiting to have him on the show until there was a good time. We're going to speak to him today. I think this is very interesting. This has a lot of implications out there, as one can imagine. As I'm recording this, the last week of February here in New York City, I'm preparing for my round the world journey, which begins tomorrow. And if you're listening to this when we drop this next week on the 6th of March, I will probably be on an airplane somewhere over Asia. It's a little bit nuts. Friday, I leave for Taipei, change planes, go to Hong Kong, doing a talk at the Upper House, a fantastic place in Hong Kong, on Monday night. And then Tuesday, I fly to Kuala Lumpur, where I'm doing a big presentation for the life insurance company Manulife, talking about all things super age. And then because Kuala Lumpur is exactly on the other side of the planet from New York, you either get to go east or west coming home. And so I said, well, I went east getting there, let's go west. So I'm flying home via Istanbul, which I think is 2 12-hour legs with a 3-hour layover. Oh my gosh. But I'm very excited about the whole thing. I want to let you guys know that I am a truthfully horrible traveler. I used to travel all the time. I used to travel Paris, New York, LA, Tokyo. That was sort of my route. And I really had it dialed in, or at least I thought I did. Maybe I didn't. But now I'm not quite as good at it. I'm especially susceptible to jet lag. So what I'm doing this week, and it makes my wife nuts that I do this, but I do it because I know jet lag just crushes me. So what I'm doing is I'm trying to adjust my clock, my circadian rhythm a little bit before I go. The technique on that is you stay up later. And for me, it's like a half hour or so a night. I sort of push it back. So tonight, oh my gosh, I'm staying up till 3 a.m. I don't know how I used to do that, like nightclubs and stuff when I was in my 20s. But anyway, don't do that anymore. I stay up late, but then what I'll do is between the hours of about 7 and 10 or 8 and 11, I try and be in a really bright room. And I've got this really bright LED light that I use for photography. I try and shine that into my eyes or part of my eyes during that time because the light is a really big part of this whole circadian shift. And then in the morning, it gets weird. You know, I get up like 11:30 or so. And then I can't be exposing myself to bright light because that'll mess up the circadian shift. So I wear sunglasses everywhere for, you know, 3 hours or so. Now, this is all fine and dandy, if a bit eccentric, when you're in your own home. But this is also the sort of routine that you have to follow in transit. So I got this mental 18-hour flight. At a certain point in that flight, like 6 hours into it, I'll turn on my portable bright LED light and shine it in my face while I'm, I don't know, doing what, reading a book or watching a movie or something. And that goes on for about 3 hours. And then depending on the time of where we are in the cycle, as far as local Hong Kong time, I'll put on sunglasses, keep the shade down. And if I'm in an airport, when that happens to happen, I'll have to keep my sunglasses on and, you know, walk around like a celebrity in disguise. So the whole thing is a bit odd and troublesome, but the payoff is I am less crushed by the jet lag. And then there's the return, where we sort of repeat the process, but the return happens really quickly. So there will be certain amount of adjustment when I get back the following week, where you just try and do your best. But it's 11 hours of jet lag into Kuala Lumpur or Hong Kong from New York. 12 hours would be worse, but 11 is pretty bad. So that's going to be my routine on that. I've got some supplements I'm going to be taking. I don't do melatonin. It really, really messes with me, even like the super low doses. I also don't do L-theanine, which turns night times into some kind of horror movie for me. So I don't do that. So we do a couple other things, possibly some pharmaceutical to help me sleep. This one, when you're going in this direction, it's not so much the falling asleep, it's the staying awake. It's tricky. If I was going to Europe, it would be the falling asleep. So yeah, better living through chemistry. We are going to get with Sunyi Lehman in just a quick moment after a word from our sponsors. Did you know that just pounding water all day is not going to keep you hydrated? You need the right mix of electrolytes in that water to help that water be absorbed properly and also to help your body function well with the right electrolytes. Element, LMNT, contains sodium, potassium, and magnesium, which are critical for helping our brains and our bodies function. One of the unfortunate facts is as we get older, it's harder to drink water, essentially because our thirst response is diminished. So we need to put extra emphasis on drinking water, staying hydrated with the right electrolytes. Of course, if you are pre-hypertensive or have hypertension, check with your doctor before having anything with sodium in it. For the rest of us, though, Element is a great solution. Go to drinkelement.com. That's drinkelement.com/ageist. Get a free 8-serving sample pack with your first purchase. One supplement that I take every day is MitoPure from Timeline Nutrition. It contains urolithin A. There's a tremendous amount of science out there about urolithin A, and it's all very positive. Urolithin A helps us with something called mitophagy, which is cleaning out our older, not-so-functional mitochondria. And at 65, I've built up some dysfunctional mitochondria. Cleans those out, replaces them with new, better-functioning mitochondria. What it does is it helps us with all the energy production in our bodies. Our brains, our immune systems, our muscles, all of those include mitochondria. They're the energy powerhouse, and we want to have the best mitochondria we can. This is why I take MitoPure every day, why members of my scientific board take it, why their families take it. It's a great product. If you go to timelinenutrition.com/ageist, use the code ageist at checkout, and you'll save 10% on your first purchase. Just a quick reminder that after my conversation with Sunyi Lehman, we will be doing Just Try This, as we do each week, that little tidbit to help you live a little healthier, a little longer, and maybe a little happier. That's right after my conversation with Sunyi Lehman. Let's give him a ring right now. Sunyi, how are you today?
I'm pretty good. There's a big time difference between us. It's getting late here, and I guess you just woke up. So I'm in the evening mood, but other than that, really great.
Where does this podcast find you today?
So I am a little bit north of Copenhagen in Denmark.
I have an opportunity to go to Copenhagen in June, which I really want to do, but I've never been to Denmark. It's one of those countries that just fascinates me, and I've never been there.
Well, I mean, I recommend that if you go, you go in summer. Right now, it's very dark and cold and gray, but in the summer, it's beautiful. So June is not a bad time.
Maybe that's what caused you guys to be Vikings. Is that?
I don't know. I think probably many and complex paths led to the Vikings, but maybe the weather played a role for sure.
So I want to talk to you about your work. You're a network and complexity scientist at the Technical University of Denmark, and you have this paper that was recently published that I read, which fascinated me, and I really wanted to speak to you about it. It's algorithms to predict health, income, and death outcomes. What are you doing here? What is this?
Yeah, all right. So this is also a really good question. So basically, the work that we do is inspired by this incredible progress that we've seen in natural language processing. So you've probably typed away at the ChatGPT or one of its brethren or sisters or whatever you call the other big chatbots that are now coming out. And essentially, that technology really is a system, you know, an AI or a machine learning algorithm that sees language as a sequence of, we call them tokens or just kind of abstract strings of something. It doesn't really understand language to begin with, but it understands that sequences are really important. And so what we thought is, from a certain perspective, you can analyze many other sequences other than language, right? So from a certain perspective, particularly lives, human lives, are sequences, right? You're born, you are seen by a doctor, they do some measurements. At some point, you go home to a house, you live in a place. And all of that information, just like words in a sentence, can be kind of structured to create, let's say, the sentence of your life. And so what we did is that we took an enormous data set, and I can talk about that too in a little bit, but essentially we have quite detailed data on everyone in Denmark. And so we created the kind of sentence of all the Danes. And then we used the same technology that lies underneath the language models, something called transformers. And we built a kind of general model for human lives. And that model, as long as you have training data, can really predict anything about humans. I mean, it might do things with kind of varying quality, but for the things that we've tested it, it performs better than any other algorithm that we can find.
The stat that I read was it is 78% accurate. I'm not sure what it's accurate at predicting. Can you talk to me about that?
Yeah, okay. So we built this model that in a way is what you could call a foundation model. That's a very general model and you can predict anything. But of course, in order to kind of demonstrate that it works, we had to choose some things to actually predict. And one of the things we chose to predict is early mortality. So basically, we took a cohort of young people between 35 and 65, and we asked the question, if we observe them from 2008 to 2016, can we predict who will die in the 4 years subsequent? So up until 2020. And so we have all the data. We have this kind of general model, the foundation model, and now we then fine-tune it, train it to make this distinction between who will live and who will die. That's really what we do. And so you do that specifically by selecting some training data. So we show it a bunch of people, and we say, this person made it, this person didn't make it, so that it can pick up the patterns that it should pay attention to in either case. And then you hold out some data, and then you look at the performance on the people where it hasn't been told the answer, but where it suggests the answer. All right, so this is what we ask it. And now for the 78%, so there's a lot of information here. So I'll take a break and ask a few questions right after this. But the 78% is basically how many correct guesses did you get out of 100? All right?
What are you guessing? The mortality outcome?
Yeah, the mortality outcome, okay. Right? So that's the accuracy. So the accuracy is just whenever you make guesses, accuracy just means how many correct guesses did you get? And what's the fraction of correct guesses? But the easiest way to think of it is 78.8 is 78.8 out of 100.
Okay. So, Sune, suppose I'm in your database and it shows you have a 95% chance of dying in the next 3 years. I'm guessing you change the inputs, you change the output, right? So do I get a phone call that says, like, you got to stop XYZ, or there's a 98% chance you're going to be dead in 3 years?
Well, I mean, so this is where we're not quite there yet. Because, you know, counter to what media leads you to believe, counter to what popular culture and movies lead you to believe, your probability of dying any given day, if you're between 35 and 65, is incredibly low, right? So basically, no one dies is kind of the starting point, right? So in the cohort that we look at, if we just made a kind of stupid algorithm that just said everyone lives, we could already get a very high accuracy. Right. So I'm explaining this, the result a little bit more before getting into answering your question, because that basically we could just say everyone survives and we would get, 97-98% accuracy. That would be a great headline because it would sound as if we were amazing, but we're just stating this obvious fact that very few young people actually pass away. Now, so the 78.8% is in another sample of individuals that's balanced. So basically we balance out the sample and we say, let's take a subgroup. Actually, this is a little bit technical, but you can think of it like this, that we balance out the subgroup in such a way that you would get, if you just guessed at random, you would get 50-50. All right. So we choose a group where there's more than just 2% that die. It's basically balanced out. And so it's in that group where a random guess would be 50-50. That we get 78.8%. And so that means that we still get, so in this group where it's a kind of a different, a little bit different question, we still perform really well. And of course we perform much better than all the other algorithms that we compare it to, but it's not insane. It's not incredible. We're not pinpointing every single one. Right. And we spend a lot of time in the paper trying to figure out what's going on, what are we doing? And this is where it kind of gets interesting, because I'm getting to answering this question that you had, because what really happens is that if you look at how the algorithm is thinking, so you can look at kind of the underlying mathematical spaces that powers the model. Basically, what it does is it organizes people more or less in a kind of in this, so there's a vector space underlying it, and inside the space, each person has a little dot, and basically it organizes people in a cylinder where all the people in one end have very low probability of dying, and they're very healthy, and it's very easy to predict that none of those people are going to die. And then it's organized so that in the other end of the cylinder, everyone is very unhealthy and has a very high probability of dying in the next 4 years. And when you look at that end of the cylinder, that's when it's difficult to actually tell who will die in the next 4 years. Because, of course, if you're incredibly sick, you know, the doctor might say, you have 3 months, you have 1 year or whatever. But we all know stories about people who live much longer than that, or people who die much sooner than that. So even if you're very sick, of course, the exact date of when you leave this planet is very difficult to pinpoint. And so this is kind of what's really underlying this prediction that we make, is that we really rank people or give you a kind of score of how the algorithm really looks at how healthy are you given the life that you've lived. And so in that sense, it is beginning to, like when you look at what the how the model thinks, it is beginning to go in the direction that you're asking about. I guess this is my long-winded way of getting to that.
This just brings up all kinds of stuff. So privacy issues. How granular is this data?
So we didn't talk about the data. But so in Denmark, it's a small little country. And one of the crazy things about the Danish people is that we trust the government. We actually think that, they're nice people. They want good things for the citizens. And so one of the things that we've decided is that it makes sense to have a place. It's a relatively independent organization called Statistic Denmark that basically stores all the information about all the Danish people. So it's all the paychecks, all the tax records, also health records, also education records, and a bunch of other stuff. So for every Dane, there is really kind of very detailed statistical information. And this is something that's also true for the other, let's say, Nordic countries. Sweden has something similar, right? In Iceland, it's even more crazy. They also have the genomic data, so they could really do some wild stuff up there. And that data set really organizes this data so that we can use it for the good of everyone. And it's organized in such a way that you can't just go and get the data. Like anyone off the street can't go and get it. And actually, there are some pieces of information that even, let's say, your doctor or some government organization can't necessarily go and get directly. But the data is available to researchers, for example. If you're any researcher affiliated with the Danish university, can go and access that data set. And once again, of course, you can't just go nuts. Like you have to say, I'd like to study this specific thing for this reason. So I'd like to this registry and this registry and this registry. And then you have to apply. Someone is going to look over your application and then approve it. And then you actually have to go physically to the building and sit there and work on the data. So it's not that you just, you know, download all of the data on the internet. There's quite a lot of security. But under all of these long kind of list of rules that I've given, you can actually do studies like this. And what I think is incredible is that it shows us, first of all, you know, what's really possible to do with detailed data like this. And it means that we can make much more informed decisions about some of these health outcomes. So in that sense, I think it's pretty fantastic. And of course, it's anonymized in there. It's not like I can go and be like, oh, I'd like to. So you're not looking at someone's data. There's some long, you know, wild identifier for each person.
I live in a country where this sort of government keeping of data would just arouse like fever dreams of black helicopters among a section of the population.
Sure. But to me, that's crazy because, you know, like you have, let's say you have Facebook, right? They have very detailed data about everything that you're interested in. On Instagram, you know, like they know what's inside every image that you look at. They can tell the different objects. They can see how long you spend looking at it. They know all the text you type. Google knows what you search for. Some of the things you search for on Google probably you wouldn't want to share with anyone, but you're generally happy to share it with some big corporation interested in making money. So I think, you know, there's a lot of data being shared and some of it probably much more sensitive than the stuff that I have access to. So it's just a matter of, is it going to some young man in Silicon Valley out with to make a lot of money, or is it going to the government, right?
Yeah. Well, in my country, we have a certain bias.
Sure.
For some reason, we're okay with Mark Zuckerberg knowing everything about us, but, you know, God forbid the government. It's a funny thing. So I'm curious, looking forward on this, as the large language models become more, your data set gets bigger and you're able to sift it more, would you see being able to use something like this at population level disease prevention, optimizing behavior? Because as you said, it's anonymized. If I'm a Dane, I'm not going to get a phone call from the Danish government saying like, you're behaving badly, you might die soon, you know, but on a larger scale, what are you seeing the positive implications of this?
Yeah. All right. So, but let me just be clear. You can actually find out, like it's anonymized so that the researchers can't tell who's who. But if we found a fantastic way of screening for some form of cancer or something like that, we could go out and tell people if we wanted to. So for now, it's a research project and it's a proof of concept. The data set still has lots of biases in there. There's lots of work that needs to be done before we can kind of start, you know, using it to predict health and be certain that we know what we're doing. But it's certainly one of the uses of something like this that I think could be super promising. So we are in the process of starting up collaborations with medical doctors, right? Because immediately, so we chose this prediction of early mortality as an example of what the algorithm could do. But lots of doctors contacted me and said, why are you predicting mortality? And why are you predicting a 4-year time frame? That's not clinically useful for anyone. Why aren't we predicting obesity, fertility, you know, serious, let's say, cancers? So lots of people have kind of contacted me around saying, let's use this for something that's actually meaningful and useful. And I think, you know, what's amazing about what we do is that we also model not just the medical data, but the data around the life that people live. And we know that a lot of lifestyle factors are at play in disease, but it's not really part of the traditional kind of medical approach. But here's a very natural way of incorporating all kinds of information into predictions around these topics.
Let's dive into that a little bit. What are these, as you say, sort of lifestyle data points that you're putting in outside of the medical stuff?
Yeah. So right now, what we're doing is we're using a data set from the labor market. That sounds already boring, but of course, what it does is it has information as it comes in about how much money someone makes, from Texas, right? So it says, how much money is someone making? Where do they live? Where is their job located? What type of job is it? What type of industry is it? So both, are you a manager in, you know, like a white collar firm or a cement production facility or whatever, like all of these informations about the type of job that you have. If you're taking an education, that's also in there. So all of this information from the labor market around, you know, what kind of work life you have and all the social information that comes with that, including, you know, the zip code where you live and so on. And then the health information is from the first contact with either if you go to the emergency room or the hospital or something like this.
Okay. And if you had your way and you were able to get more data, it's interesting that people are coming to you with, you know, okay, mortality, that's not that useful. Fertility, that's useful. Cancer isn't. That's very useful. What are the other sort of inputs that you would like to see that you don't have at the moment?
Well, so first of all, what's amazing about the model that we created from a kind of like from my perspective, the science, basic science perspective, is that it can eat any kind of data and then build this kind of general model of how all kinds of aspects in a life relate to one another, and then use that for predictions. And so that means that, you know, that you can feed it anything and then it'll figure out what's important and what's not important when you make predictions, right? And so people have been making, of course, lots of predictions before models like mine, but for all of those, you as the researchers, you've had to kind of sit down and think, what is the information I want for this prediction, right? So if you're predicting longevity, let's say, you would say, okay, well, the person's age right now is probably important. There are certain biomarkers that you would look at. There are certain lifestyle things. And then you would build a model around what you thought might be important. But what's cool about this model is you just throw all of it in there in the sequence, and the model figures out how these things relate to one another in human lives. And then when you then train it to make a prediction, it will figure out what's important. So you can potentially discover new things that might be important. So in a way, like, I would like to put just as much stuff in there as you could come up with and then see, you know, what does the model make of it? And this is also why, again, when we talk about the tech companies and so on, I'm pretty sure that they could also build some pretty wild algorithms of this kind because they have so much behavioral data from all of us, essentially. So that's the kind of general answer to this question. If that makes sense.
It does. I didn't realize the methodology of this. That's super interesting.
And can I just want to say one more thing, I guess? So what's really interesting is to understand how much better, or if we even get better as we add more data. Like, have we already saturated the fundamental predictability of human lives? Maybe there's something just built into, you know, how we interact and how random everything is that we can't get any closer. Or do we get better when we add more data? That's really an open question. And of course, another thing that we'd like to add is something like network information. We know that the people in your life are super important. If you have healthy and good and lots of relationships, you know, you're more healthy, you live longer. The people in your life change your life. If something terrible happens to an important person in your life, it also impacts you negative. So how do your kind of the connections that you form in the network, how do they relate to our ability to predict the next things that happens? So those are some of the things that we're interested in from a research perspective.
Thinking about the networking nodes, my head hurts just thinking about like that. I'm glad I don't have your job. I could not do this.
But the way you think about a human life is really, or at least in this model, is that you think of each one of us as a sequence of events where one after the other, you know, comes in time and time runs along the axis. And then those sequences are coupled through relationships. So they interact, right? And if something happened in your significant other's life, it then changes also the sequence that you're living. So that's really how we think about it and how we're going to model it moving forward.
I love that. But I'm just thinking of like, thank God there are companies like NVIDIA that have created these GPUs that can actually do this. Because as I'm thinking about, oh my gosh, like one person, maybe he's got like 20 or 30 inputs, but he's got maybe 10 people. And then the permutations of that, it's like,
for sure. That's a lot big of, number. There's a lot of permutations. That's for sure. But yeah.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. And I'm guessing, you know, as you mentioned, there the Nordic companies, Denmark, and then Iceland has maybe a little more because they got the genetics. But very few countries, I think, have this kind of data. So if this gets better, I mean, one of the interesting things about the countries that you mentioned is they all have pretty good health outcomes. You guys tend to be pretty happy on the scale, even despite the fact there's no sun there this time of year. You're still like a pretty happy lot versus other places with much lower lifespans, health spans, not quite so happy. They don't seem to also have the data. Would you see a way to bring this to that sort of a culture?
So I think how well this translates is a question that can be answered. So we haven't answered it yet. My hunch is that some things will generalize and we can really move this and use it in many, many different places. And I think some things are kind of peculiar to whatever country you record the data in, right? Figuring out what's what is one of the things that we have to work to find out, right? And so if you think about the biology, right, some of the things are very fundamental and are true for anyone who is a human person. Some things do depend on ethnicity, right? Yeah, like diabetes comes to mind, where actually there are some important differences that you need to take care of in treating diabetes, let's say. And so, you know, the Danes are a kind of quite homogeneous group of people on the whole. And so, of course, we won't, like some of those results won't generalize, but I think lots of results will generalize. Things about the labor market is again, some things are quite general. I think, you know, it's good for your health to be wealthy and a manager and all of these, a lot of these social things probably can generalize, but there are also things related to, you know, like we have public, free public education, even at the highest level. We have free healthcare. We have a lot of kind of public institutions that are not necessarily available to everyone. And so that will also shape the outcomes. Even having kind of, you know, like let's think about the networks. You know, it means something to have really good health insurance in a family versus not having it, right? And in Denmark, of course, it's also detrimental if someone is seriously ill in a family, but with a kind of social safety net, some of the downstream effects on the life sequences of those people will be quite different, I suspect.
I'm thinking that here in the sort of hyper-capitalist society that I live in, companies like life insurance, you know, they want to know, do I smoke? Do I jump out of airplanes? Do I deep sea dive? But it's pretty blunt stuff. I can imagine them being very interested in this, or health insurance companies being very interested in this.
Yeah. I think my stance on that is that the whole point of insurance is to share risk, right? And that this basically is a machine that enables you to not share risks as much. And so here I think of the work that we produce as a kind of reminder that, you know, the insurance industry was regulated quite heavily. And the notion of protected attributes like race and gender and so on, that's really important in American law, was instituted in order to say everyone should be treated equally and fairly, for example, in insurance contexts. And so here, basically, we built a machine to say, now we can tell who is going to be the unlucky person, you know, where something bad might happen to them. And so it's clear that that means that you no longer have to share the risk with that person. This algorithm basically undermines the whole concept of insurance. And so what the work that we've made here kind of suggests to me that maybe we need another round of legislation around insurance to make sure that we still share the risk and to make sure that it's still something that's fair. That's really what I suggest. I think that if insurance companies start doing something like this, it's bad news for all of us.
Yeah, they will. Unless somebody legislates something, they will.
Yeah, but sure. But I mean, but at least it's happened before. It has been possible to actually say, you know what, people shouldn't pay different insurance premiums if they're of different races just because of that attribute. And I think that's something that we can probably all agree that that's something that's pretty fair. And so hopefully understanding that something like this is possible also means that someone will say, well, maybe we need to get back at it and actually make sure that insurance remains something that's fair and actually helps people.
I want to get into something, a completely different topic here.
Sure.
Because you're Dane, and I'm going to have you speak on part of your entire country. I just read this book, Winter Swimming, and there's a whole sort of, I guess, movement, maybe mania here in the States around sauna. And I guess you would call voluntary cold exposure, which seems to be something that you guys have been doing for. Do you do this?
Yeah, I do. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm a little bit also part of this, like maybe an early adopter. So I don't know when, I don't know, maybe 5, 6, 7 years ago, my wife and I kind of started as our, you know, the kids could be home for an hour and we'd go out to the ocean and go for a swim. And so that's a kind of a thing that we do to get away together. And it's amazing. I love it. I think it's a thing because it's this kind of voluntary cold exposure is just amazing and fantastic. That's my stance on that. I'm happy to elaborate. Have you tried it?
Yeah. Not in the ocean, but I'm in New York City today, but I'm often in Park City, Utah, and the gym that I go to, one of the pools is heated and one of them isn't. So it gets seriously cold there in the winter. So we'll start going in that pool sometime like October. It'll be like Fahrenheit, like 60 degrees. But by the end of November, it's getting close to freezing. And then by December, we go out with a barbell and we break the ice and you have to pull the ice out. It's very sharp. It'll cut you.
Yeah.
And then I went out there, I'm sort of telling people about this, and we would get more of us. We would do the sauna first. I chose that gym because the sauna is incredibly hot. And so we bake ourselves and we go out there and we go in the water. But then getting out of the water, how do you get out of a pool? There are these aluminum handles, right? Now, those aluminum handles are significantly below freezing and you're wet. So what happens? You put your hands on them and it's just, you're like, the first time I did, I thought, oh my God, you idiot. And then my hands are frozen in this pipe. And then I sort of crank them off and get out. And
wow.
Yeah. Well, mind you, I'm in that water. That's like 30 seconds or something, maybe 45 seconds. If it's more like ocean water. So that's more, you know, maybe 10 degrees above freezing, which is still circulating water really cold, you know, I can do that for like 2 or 3 minutes. That's about it for me.
Yeah. Maybe the water, I mean, we go out, maybe it's a little bit closer to freezing even in the ocean water. Actually, this Christmas was very cold and we were swimming in the ocean with ice floating around, you know, so you have to push it was incredible. And I don't know. Yeah. I can also do a couple minutes around those conditions. The real joy of it is the kind of incredible boost of well-being you get upon getting out of the water.
Absolutely.
I mean, I'm getting to the point. I told my wife recently, I said, you know, even if this was in no way good for me, I think I'd continue doing it.
Yeah.
Because the kind of boost in well-being I get from getting out of the water is just it's just unbelievable. It's really fantastic.
So our travel editor lives on the North Fork of Long Island, and she swims in the North Atlantic 365. And
yeah.
So she tells me, like, come February, the water becomes gelatinous, and she's out there swimming, and it's like, oh my God! But I'm with you. The reason I do it, the reason I live in the building I do in New York, is they have a traditional hot sauna, they have a steam room, and they have a cold plunge.
Yeah.
The cold plunge isn't as cold as what you're going in, but it's cold, pretty cold. And I tell people, it's like, well, the first 20 seconds are horrible. You just have to you're just not going to be unpleasant. I don't care. It's just not fun. But then everything sort of equalizes in this funny way. But then
the human body is unbelievable, right? Because it really is a machine. And when you first go in, especially in the beginning, you really think, all right, I'm going to die. It's over.
Everything hurts. It really hurts.
And then your body is kind of like, all right, you know, like you have this panic, and then the body's just goes like, all right, this is the situation now. You know, we have to navigate. You come all the way down. You're in there, and all of a sudden you can breathe, and you have this kind of grace period, as we talked about, of a couple of minutes. And you shouldn't stay in too long. You know, then you'll start shaking when you come out. There's serious risks of hypothermia and so on. But you really get this deep calm. And and then, as we talked about, when you get out, then you get this incredible boost of endorphins and dopamine.
Yeah, neuroadrenaline.
Yeah, it's unbelievable.
I tell people, like, if you got a complex math problem you want me to do, get me when I come out of the cold. And my brain is in hyper, like, whatever complex problem, I can do it.
Yeah, no, it's unbelievable. It's really fantastic. Yeah. And, you know, I have a place where I can go with a sauna, but most of the time we even go without the sauna. I mean, this is another wild thing that you can just... Your body is perfectly capable of going in the water, going for a swim, coming out, and then you put on some warm clothes and you're fine. It's really amazing.
You guys are the original Vikings, though. So, you know, that's this is wonderful. What is it that you want my people to know about the work that you're doing today?
Well, so what I think is exciting is that this is really kind of a new way of modeling data about people, and it's a new way of gaining understanding about human lives. And what we're doing is that we're kind of saying, you know, social scientists, public health have been looking at these kinds of problems for a long time, especially in terms of prediction, not with like a huge amount of success, especially in the social sciences, but also in the health space that you're in here. And then we have, you know, the tech companies that have made these enormous advances in making predictions, that they can really make incredible predictions running algorithms like the ones that we talked about. And I think that there's an enormous potential in kind of taking algorithms that are really now mostly engineering happening inside big tech companies and then moving them over to this kind of sphere of where we're trying to figure out how things work, how they operate. And and even though it's scary that we're so predictable and we can be predicted by the tech companies, it also means that there's something there to be discovered, to be figured out. And I'm really kind of excited about using some of these technologies to try and open them up and try and understand how they work so that we can use those insights to, you know, get smarter and live longer, hopefully.
That sounds good to me. Sunye, thank you so much. I hope one day soon, maybe this summer, I will come and visit your country. And if so, we can do, well, summer, not winter. Well, even that's the North Atlantic in
still
June.
Pretty cold.
It's still
pretty cold. Yeah, for sure. No, that'd be wonderful. Thank you for having me on and hearing about it. I know it got quite technical and hopefully it wasn't too boring. It was really a pleasure.
My people are smart. They got it.
All right. That's awesome.
Okay.
Wonderful.
Thanks so much for your time today. I appreciate it.
Take care.
Mm-hmm. Bye now. It was so good of Sunye to make some time to talk to us today. You know, that's one of the things that I love about doing the Super Age podcast is I'm able to have conversations with super smart people like this who are doing such interesting work. I hope this is informative and helpful and perhaps entertaining to all of you too. And hey, if you guys ever have a suggestion of somebody out there you want me to hit up to have on the podcast, just do that. DavidSuperAge.com. Happy to check it out for you. We are going to get with Just Try This after a quick word from our sponsors. Today's show is also brought to you by Inside Tracker, the dashboard to your inner health. I've been using Inside Tracker for over 3 years now. I've been able to reduce my inner age from my chronological age of 65 to an inner age now of 56. I did this gradually over time, following their recommendations. Because not only with Inside Tracker do I have a dashboard to my inner health, knowing what's going on inside me, I also have a roadmap on how to improve that. Their food first, supplement second recommendations have helped me tremendously. I recommend everyone get a dashboard to their inner health. Go to insidetracker.com/ageist. Save 20% on all their products. This week on Just Try This, I'm going to talk a little bit about something super easy we can do and is top of mind for me with my circadian shift going on, which is our relationship to sunlight. You know, one of the things that's really easy to do to increase our mood, to help us get through the day, is just go out early in the morning and try and get some natural light on your face. If you can, the optimal thing is the sun just after it comes across the horizon to get some of that on your skin, in your eyes for, you know, just like 10 or 15 minutes. And don't stare at the sun. That's not a great idea. This will really help set up your clock for the day, set up your mood for the day. I know that sometimes I forget to do that, especially if I'm in New York. I may be inside a building, you know, up until, you know, 2 or 3 in the afternoon, or if it's raining outside, sometimes I don't go outside at all. This is not optimal. It's really better to go out there, get a little bit of sunlight, get a little bit of air, whatever's going on outside, it's not going to be that bad. And the impact of having this little bit of sunlight on our faces is really tremendous through the day, especially for people who suffer with some depression or sort of a low moment towards the end of the day or towards the middle of the day. 4 o'clock is my low moment. So just try that. Try and get a little bit of sunlight in the morning if you can. Don't stare at the sun and see if that helps. See if that makes a bit of a difference for you with your day. That's just try this week. Okay, everybody, that wraps it for this week. I got a favor for you before you go. I ask every week, and some of you guys have still not done this, so I'm going to ask again and again and again. Could you please leave us a rating wherever you're listening to this podcast? Can you leave us a comment? That's such a great thing to do. I know that some of you folks out there in Asia are listening to this. You too can leave a comment. You can leave a rating up to 5 stars. We love 5 stars. And if you really like us, you could share the Super Age podcast with somebody you know and ask them to subscribe too. Everyone, until next week, hoping you have a wonderful week. You get some sun out there and enjoy life. It's a magical thing.